Welcome to TWIL, The Week in Health Law, the podcast of record for the discussion of health law and policy. We're recording this episode on April 21st, 2015. I'm Nicholas Terry, a law professor at Indiana University McKinney School of Law in Indianapolis, and my co-host is...
Frank Pasquale, a law professor at the University of Maryland Francis King Carey School of Law in Baltimore, Maryland.
And today we're joined by Michelle Meyer. Michelle is professor and director of bioethics policy in the Union Graduate College Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai Bioethics Program. Whew, that needs punctuation, Michelle. Michelle is a noted authority on public health ethics and bioethics, so welcome to you.
Thanks for having me, and apologies for the unmanageable affiliation.
A few months back, the Facebook experiments, the social trials, flamed across the internets, and I have to admit that I was one of the people who, at first sight, started jumping up and down near my web browser, screaming, saying, "This is terrible! What is Facebook up to?" And I was so impressed to be reined in by Michelle and the piece she did for Nature, which I was very proud to be able to be asked to sign on with. And so perhaps we could start there, Michelle, and get your sense of where we are in this sort of burgeoning area of sort of crowdsourcing research. We've got Apple's research kit that recently came out, and to get a sense of how you see what's going on there as far as the actual research. I think you're very well placed for that because of where you work, but also your sense of what the important rather than sort of initial emotional issues are as we look forward into sort of the regulatory space.
Sure. Well, thanks for the kind words. I confess this is the first time I'm hearing that there was any change of heart. I thought I had just snagged the low-hanging fruit in terms of people who had signed that. So that's nice to hear, I suppose, that there was some sort of persuasion happening there. I view, you know, what happened with Facebook and the sort of similar OkCupid experiment that came to light, you know, a few weeks later, as a bit different than this other movement that's happening now with ResearchKit and one of the major distinctions, of course, is the presence or absence of informed consent. So, you know, the ResearchKit obviously involves informed consent, and frankly, it builds in a version of informed consent that I think is better than quite a bit of informed consent that exists in a sort of static document that folks get when they think about joining a clinical trial. The Facebook and OkCupid experiments raise very different questions. There, for various reasons, you know, informed consent is infeasible to get. And so the questions are, you know, to what extent is it acceptable to conduct research, whether it's an experimental design or not, without informed consent? And do we care that these are companies doing this? Is that a point against them or is that a point in favor? Do we want to hold academics to a higher standard? And so there's this sort of whole range of questions there. And, you know, I view the Facebook and OkCupid experiments as really representative of just one category within the broader category of corporate experimentation or company experimentation. And that category is experiments that are designed or at least have the potential to illuminate the effects of a company's practice or their product or their service. So OkCupid didn't really know, you know, it distinguishes itself in its marketplace by touting its matching algorithm. It says, you know, love, we do love based on math. It's extremely accurate. It's all sort of all of its promotional materials. But the truth is they really didn't know whether there was any there to their matching algorithm. And so you can look at that experiment as a way of them trying to figure out, admittedly after the fact, whether their promotional statements are in fact accurate and whether the service that they provide is actually, you know, effective. Facebook, I think, extending this sort of FDA safety and efficacy analogy, I think Facebook for me is about safety of their service, really. So, you know, they really innovated in a big way in 2006 through newsfeed. It's difficult, I think, for a lot of us to look back now and appreciate how novel that was. When Facebook started, of course, everybody had a wall, I think it was what was called at the time. And if you wanted to know what was happening with, you know, a friend or an ex, you had to sort of quasi-stalk them. You had to, you know, point your Facebook, you know, the URL within Facebook to their page and see whether they had any status updates. And that was, you know, very quickly got tedious. And so the innovation was to just aggregate all of this and have it be on everybody's home page of their Facebook page. And to the point where newsfeed basically is Facebook now. But, you know, it was novel at the time, not just for Facebook, but for really anything on the internet, to have this constantly updating aggregation of the goings-ons and thoughts of everyone in your sort of social cohort. And, you know, you might think, well, so what? You know, what's the big deal? And again, in 2015, it's difficult, I think, to look back and see this as, how could this possibly be problematic? But in fact, academics immediately started investigating as best they could through observational methods, not having access to the algorithm themselves, the effects of this. And there were a range of hypotheses. And some of them suggested that, you know, happy Facebook posts, especially of the bragging, you know, humble brag type, perhaps, caused a range of psychological, you know, negative emotions, resentment, jealousy, loneliness, depression, that kind of thing. Another completely mutually exclusive hypothesis said that, no, in fact, you know, emotions are contagious, much like a virus is contagious. And they are, you know, mostly that had been shown in face-to-face social networks, but the argument, the hypothesis was that this perhaps extended to online networks as well, and therefore happy Facebook posts would be a benefit. Actually, you would sort of catch your friend's happiness. But on the other hand, if you had a lot of, you know, depressive friends on Facebook, then those were risky. And so I think it's worth thinking about the Facebook experiment as, you know, a potentially laudable way of trying to sort this out in a way that academics could not without access to the algorithm, when without conducting a randomized controlled trial.
You know, Michelle, I wanted to ask about sort of the contextualizing the your intervention into the debates on it in sort of a broader sense of the relationship between, say, ethics experts and academics to Silicon Valley. And one of the notable quotes from Christian Rutter of OkCupid, I think after the experiment was surfaced, was someone said, you know, did you ever think about, say, having ethics experts to consult, or having folks that would, you know, play a role in thinking about this? And I think his response was a very flippant, why would I want to do that? I would just be paying someone $100,000 a year to wring their hands, end quote. And I'm wondering if, you know, are you sensing that Silicon Valley is starting to recognize the expertise of bioethics experts and others as having something to say here? Or do you think that there's a larger deregulatory tide, you know, washes away not merely lawyerly interventions, but also the role that would be played by, say, ethics experts in these companies or consulting with them?
So the short answer is, you know, I don't have any sense, especially that Silicon Valley views ethics, research ethics, bioethics as the folks that make up that field as having any particular expertise. You know, Facebook's response to the, you know, public reaction to the mood contagion experiment included a commitment to a more rigorous internal process of vetting, you know, protocols implemented by people on the inside using a new set of guidelines, but they declined to share with the public lines are, and they, you know, the committee that's sort of reviewing these things and applying whatever guidelines these are is all internal. You know, there are many flaws of the IRB system, but one strength is that, you know, by federal law, it's required to have at least one member who is a non-affiliate. And, you know, there's a pretty obvious reason for that. So, you know, it's hard to say, you know, who comprise these committees, presumably data privacy officers, social scientists, data scientists, et cetera. It's not clear, you know, what, if any, ethics training they'll have or think that they need.
So let's move out of this sort of this very new area of Facebook and OkCupid into an area that I think we thought we knew about, right? Which was traditional IRB regulated research, and lately crowdsourcing and research kit appears to be standing a lot of what we thought we knew on its head. And I wonder whether you think that is an overreaction or whether we're just leveraging new technologies to be smarter about doing the things we should have been doing.
Well, can I ask you to hum a few more bars, Nick, about the standing on the head bit? In what way do you think, or do others think, that research kit, et cetera, is standing traditional ethics or regulation on its head?
Well, I think the issue of consent certainly looks different. It seems to feel different. The sort of the purely technically, technologically mediated relationship, which also involves, let's face it, at least perhaps in perception, the inclusion of the platform owner, in this case, Apple. And I guess as you get to a massive or potentially massive online group of data subjects, what do we know? Does it matter who's in that group? Does size kill any problems about bias and attrition and so on? So I guess some of those things I've seen in some of the comments.
I think some of the criticism is an overreaction, yes, and also a failure to kind of compare what we might call e-research to brick-and-mortar research. So on the consent issue, you know, the comparison has to be to, you know, the other type of consent that we have now, rather than to some platonic form of ideal or perfect consent. You know, and what we know is that an awful lot of prospective research participants simply don't read some or all or any of the often long legalese consent forms. IRBs have, you know, for a variety of reasons, generally had the effect of creating longer consent forms. And those consent forms tend to be very static. They provide a whole lot of information, and the prospective participant is not equally interested, likely, in all of it. And there's not an obvious way. I mean, you can sort of bold and put things in different formats and different font sizes, but there are, you know, there's a limit to sort of how you can. And it's all very rarely the case that an IRB requires or researchers deign to determine whether subjects actually, in fact, comprehend what they may or may not have read. So, you know, if you look at Research Kit, at least at the first five apps that have come out, you know, we'll see what happens with additional apps, and if the Android community gets involved, that's a whole different ball of wax. So we'll see what happens there. But the template that Apple has created does, I think, a really good job in terms of consent, and it provides a module right in there for testing consent. e-consent is also not new. E-consent is as quote-unquote old as, you know, the internet and other technologies involved. So there's Mechanical Turk. There's a lot of psychology research, sort of, you know, well-being research involves even smartphones where, you know, participants are pinged, you know, at periodically throughout the day for a number of days or weeks to do a quick survey of how they're feeling in that moment. So these are not all, you know, completely new. And I guess I would have similar responses in terms of the bias of, you know, the sort of self-selection bias. So it's definitely true that iPhone users, I mean, ResearchKit is limited to not only iPhone users, but to late model iPhone users. And we know that folks with late model iPhones tend to skew demographically in various ways. They tend to be, you know, more educated than average, whiter than average, you know, more, you know, wealthier than average and so forth. But one, that's also true of most people who participate in clinical trials. So that is a problem. It's something we should worry about, but it's something that's not unique to e-consent or e-research. And two, you know, mobile technology has been a sort of tech diffusion success story, really diffusing to low and middle income countries much faster, I think, than a lot of people would have predicted. And, you know, I think sooner rather than later, this is actually going to be a way of getting a much more diverse subject pool and therefore data that, you know, speaks to many more of us and not just to so-called weird, you know, Western educated, whatever the weird acronym stands for, participants.
That is a very hopeful vision, Michelle. And yeah, I do think that there's a real need in these contexts to always beware of the Nirvana fallacy. You know, I mean, I've definitely cited lots of, quote, critiques of big data from people like Paul Ohm and Tim Harford and Dana Boyd and Kate Crawford. And I really admire their work. But I think you're absolutely right to point out that you have to always say compared to what. And this could well be a way of ensuring a much more representative sample in many contexts.
Yeah, there are also some scientific advantages. You know, it's really amazing. We have smartphones that have clinical grade data sensors in a commercial grade device. And so not only do we have 40,000 people signing up almost overnight for those first five apps, so that's a huge, you know, N right there. But even with, you know, per subject, we've got many, many, many more data points. So rather than, you know, if you're trying to track the progression of Parkinson's, for example, rather than having somebody come in the clinic, I mean, it's just inefficient. You know, it's very burdensome. It's one of the reasons why people don't participate in trials and in various studies, because it's burdensome. So when, you know, the researcher and the participants all have to meet in some brick and mortar place in this particular time, you know, feasibly, you can't really collect data more than, you know, either once a week or every day, but then you have to stop the trial after one day. I mean, it's hard to do a longitudinal trial with lots of data points if there has to be an in-person data collection. This, you know, has data collection, many, many more data points. So there's also that trade-off, you know, and I think smartphone research is not going to replace standard clinical trials anytime soon. But I do think it has a real place in research.
Finally, let me open things up a little bit and ask you the 5,000 foot question, Michelle. As you look at bioethics, as you look at research ethics out for the next 2-5 years, maybe, what are the things that you're watching for? What are the things that that interest you?
Well, you know, research has been marked by a sort of research exceptionalism. It's almost built into the common rule. In fact, it is built into the common rule, the so-called research practice distinction, where, you know, we make these distinctions precisely in order to regulate research more stringently than we regulate practice. And that, you know, those chickens are coming home to roost a little bit in the era of learning healthcare systems, where, you know, we're realizing or admitting that so much of medicine and public health practice and other areas of practice aren't evidence-based. And clinical trials, you know, in a sort of lab setting are great, but what they give you in terms of internal validity, they sort of take away in terms of external validity. You know, once you introduce an intervention that has been shown to be effective in a very contrived setting, it may not translate into a population where there's comorbidities and all kinds of other confounding factors. And so we really are going to have to integrate research into a variety of practice settings. And that is challenging for the structure that we have that sort of assumes a sharp distinction between the patient-physician relationship and the researcher-participant or subject relationship. So I'm, you know, I'm very interested in seeing how we will move forward. Of course, the you know, NPRM, the long-awaited you know, revision to the common rule, of course, I'm interested in that, and also what they do, what OHRP does with the standard of care rules that it has proposed, and sort of comparative effectiveness research. And then also how this new wave of, you know, not only research kit, but lots of conventional researchers are moving to Facebook. And they're saying, let's have a Facebook app for our participants. And maybe that will, you know, it will help recruitment. It will help, you know, get them to sign in more regularly. If we're using a medium, again, to go back to Facebook, if, you know, the average person in the U.S. spends 40 minutes a day on Facebook. And so there's, you know, obvious reasons to kind of embed research data collection into a Facebook app. But then it raises sort of these interesting questions about voluntariness. You know, when your friend issues a status update saying, you know, I've just enrolled in such and such Facebook app, you know, in memory of dear Uncle Fred who passed from, you know, colon cancer, won't you please join me? Is that sort of social networking recruitment, you know, manipulative in a way that should trouble us? You know, I don't know. I think the conventional answer is yes, because research has to be, you know, one of my favorite examples of how exceptional research ethics is this well-known IRB handbook where researchers are instructed, or IRBs are instructed, to require researchers to submit, who want to recruit through a radio ad, to first submit the text that they want to, you know, read. And then after that's approved, then they have to do a beta of the actual recording so that, and I quote, the tone is not coercive. So the conventional way we look at research ethics is to be very, very vigilant about any form of manipulation. And so integrating research into things like social networks really, you know, really problematizes that in a way that I think might, you know, might be okay. I think it's time that you know, we think more about risk and we think, you know, more about the particular type of research and not just research qua research versus practice.
And that was this week's The Week in Health Law. A very special thank you to Michelle Meyer for joining us. Michelle can be found on Twitter at Michelle N. Meyer. That's MichelleN. MeyeR. Michelle, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. It was a lot of fun.
You can contact me at Nicholas Terry, that's NicolasTerry on Twitter. And Frank, where can they find you?
I'm at Frank Pasquale on Twitter.
Thank you for joining us. Have a legally interesting but healthy week.